And so we have changes in anatomy, the structure of the brain. We have changes in electrophysiology, and we have many gene changes. You can measure specific molecular changes in these cells themselves. And currently, this only informs us that there are many changes that are occurring, and trying to understand how this all fits together is our challenge at this point. But the summary is that adult environmental enrichment, or what we think of as repetitive activity by virtue of this activity in the running wheel, this movement for hours and hours on end, voluntary, I guess that's, yes, thank you, voluntary, increases neurogenesis, and it increases in learning. And it does this in age-related decline. So even in very, very old animals, and recently in a wonderful study in women in an old folks' home, were given an opportunity to get out of their home and move around in a garden every day for 2 hours, and then they were tested before and after on a recognition test and a willingness to do tests, and their willingness to involve in things was increased if you let them go outside and move around within the gardens. And so the people are actually beginning to take some of this data from the animals and apply it in hospital settings as well. So their enrichment decreases decline in cognition. If you have two genetic strains, genetic strains.
페지 지지 아 다나디 그 체부 누시 그 영어로 먹고 세상 그걸 커두다가 류부터네 번에 가서 그래 그 뉴레 당시에 죄송 에 그것도 쓰다 쓰면 지도 그 기울어 주시지 제대로 봐 답변에 밀리야 다나 챙해라 그 류부천에 다 탄체 류부천에다 진이 만들지 이네 딱고 내 류제 장에 이 풀을 막 개변 여러 삼배 포기하는 그 사람 따니 퇴직은 류네 폐지를 낙전수 요지 폐지 연구래 죄송아 자다 풀 편도 지니 다디 가서 그래 미유 두비아 된다 야 류비 강에 캡스야 준 거보다 다디 원리대로 만다 정성이야
when we speak of volitional activity here and when it seems to be clear that the voluntary activity, the term voluntary seems to be an important qualifier here. So Isolde was saying, in the case of the example of the mouse, the calculation is not really going to be long term. The mouse is physically fit and enjoys doing the exercise and does it voluntarily. But in the case of human beings,
so animal, they have no idea. This is something short term, very tired, very sort of difficult, even physically. You see, maybe there is some feeling of reluctance. But in animal case, if physically reluctant, then they will stop. But we human being,
we can overcome that.
The bigger goal there. So physically reluctant, but mentally volunteer.
Exactly.
So that's about the way. So
will that make a difference between the?
Yeah, I
so
think
volunteer,
this is
there are two types of volunteer.
Yeah, no, I think this is where the ability to do experiments in animals is at a disadvantage because you can't do that kind of experiment in an animal where you could somehow convince them or that this will be good for you. You know, in the long run, it'll be good for you. I think that this is fairly new, and these discussions actually will inform scientists to think about experiments that might try to do that, you know, to try to separate out these different types of volition.
Oh, yes. That's right.
So even among human beings, we can see a distinction between the children who naturally play. There's a much higher level of kind of, you know, preparedness on the part of the body as well, and mentally as well. But later on, with adults, it, it's different. There's less physical reluctance. And even then, you could also see among the adults who, you know, for the sake of fame, like the great athletes, they're willing to go to great lengths to put their body to test and do some exercises. The voluntariness, the volition has a different degrees.
The children get the physical advantage, but it's a side product because they really enjoy it, whereas an adult athlete may go through a great ardor, but not just because out of fun, but for the anticipated benefit, being the Super Bowl or whatever it may be.
So in neurogenesis declines with age. It's not constant. So in very old, as people age, the rate at which the cells are born declines. And you can take a very, very old animal, and this has been done in mouse as well as in primates, and give them access to a broader experience, an enriched experience, so they interact more with the environment or they can running wheel. They do run less than the young animal, but the effect on neurogenesis is even greater because their baseline is low. And the effect on cognition is very big because they've declined so much. So there's a fellow in Boston who's an architect and a social scientist named John Zeisel who is designing new homes for the aged, which encourage them to interact in their environment more. So they have to wind around different areas to get to the food, but not in a stressful way. So he's got to work this parallel between, or the balance between stress, too much stress, and yet complexity. Enough complexity to make it interesting, but not too complex so you get frustrating. And that balance in these aged homes is turning out to be really quite successful. So the other thing that's just the other list of things are that these enriching experiences and repetitive activities also can overcome induced anxiety as well as sleep deprivation. They're very effective on sleep deprivation. So that I'm just surveying for you much of the literature, and there is some weak evidence but emerging evidence that learning itself, process of learning and experience, can have an effect not so much on the birth of new neurons, but how quickly they integrate into the circuit. And this is obviously one of the areas that's very important for us to understand, and I can only say that there are many experiments being designed to try and find out if the internal representation of a learning experience could actually result in a greater amount of neurogenesis. So, you know, I wanted to go back to my beginning. And so I've said that there's neurogenesis that occurs in the brain, but I also started off by talking about synapses and spines and connections, and I wanted to get back to that because I think it's not just the birth of the neurons that's important. Really what it comes down to is how these connections are made. And we're just beginning to get at that. So this is a reminder of the circuit. So that you've got, this is the area where neurogenesis is occurring, and it's the gateway for information, and as the information circulates through here and then goes back out to the cortex. So we can mark these cells genetically in the brain so we can visualize them very clearly. So this is, for example, in an adult animal, this is a newly born cell, so it's a month old, but in a very old animal. So we know that this is a new cell because we can genetically tag it at a particular moment in time. So then we can see it in the microscope, and we know that there is the newly born cell, and we can finally ask, does that cell that's born in the adult brain, is it functional? Does it work? How well does it work? And these are just fluctuations of an electrode in the cell, but you can demonstrate that they look like a neighboring cell that's been there for a long period of time. However, they're young at 1 month. They're like they're immature, and they don't have all their connections yet. And in fact, it takes 2 or 3 months after the cell matures enough so it can calculate before it's as mature as the other cells, the more mature cells in its brain. So, which was a bit of a surprise for us. And so we wanted to understand, I want to take a moment just on this point, because we're trying to understand why is it that the brain would retain, would keep this ability to continue bringing new cells in? Why is that important? Why would we have this process at all? And the emerging idea is that it's a self-renewing process of immaturity, of youth, that's being brought into the structure, so you can make new connections all the time. And it's not the birth of the cell that's so important, but it's the connections that are important. So you want this reservoir or this cache of young cells there all the time to be able to be prepared to recognize novelty, to recognize new experiences. And without that, you'll have this sort of fixed connections, unable to recognize and acquire new information. So, an example would be, I mean, just have to envision what it would be if we couldn't recognize novelty, if we could not, we couldn't see things as different, actually. And one of the discussions about people that are emotionally depressed, or emotionally distressed, is that they're unable to recognize novelty, that everything is just the same. And you hear this a lot with depressed people, is that it's just the same. Things just look the same to me, and there's nothing exciting in life. And it it turns out these individuals have shrunken hippocampus. These are correlations, but they do have shrunken hippocampus. And with drugs and with therapy, the hippocampus swells. And part of the argument is that depression is not because a direct effect, the direct effect of experience is the inability to recognize novelty. And the inability to recognize things as new, as fresh, as different, this is what elicits the depressing response. So depression may well be in part a function of sameness. So I'm a neurobiologist, so I like to find out if I can see this. Can I see if there is a difference between cells that are fixed in the circuit and cells that are active, still learning, still able to make connections? So new technology has been developed, new microscopes that allow you to zoom in and visualize in certain conditions, living cells and their connection, very high. So here we can see, we think that these are all connections at very, these are our spines again, these are the ones receiving information on the dendrite. This is the dendritic shaft along here, and these are the guys that are reaching out to make connections. This is, the filipodia, which is most prominent during early development. But surprisingly, we're beginning to see these also in the newly born cells of the adult. And here you can see, so here are these newborn cells. We know exactly when they were born, a month earlier. And this is an older animal. And we go higher, and we see all these nice little spines here. Okay, so here is a movie of one of these spines of a cell that's only 3 weeks old. So this is a dendrite. Let me go back to here. Go back. So we're taking this segment right here, and it's a live picture of a real dendrite, alive. So all the movement is watching it. And the little parts that are coming off, you can see, are the spines as they're existing.
This is in real time?
This is in real time. So this whole movie takes 15 minutes. Oh, no, sorry, it's 15-minute period of time. But it's fairly short. I mean, it's condensed. Mm-hmm. And what I want you to see, and I don't know if you can see, maybe you will be able to see, is this right here. Here, oh, can you see this guy jumping out like that? Mm-hmm. That's a filopodial spine that's out searching for a connecting point.
Like a youngster.
Like a youngster. And you don't ever see these in adult. This is a cell that's fixed. See, they have many more connections. And this is now 5 months old, much older, more mature. And they have none of these connections. This guy has very few of them, but they're very modal. They're out searching around. So this is our first indication that there's a physical underpinning for this dynamic difference that exists between new cells that exist in the circuit that are still learning and still interacting, and those that are fairly fixed in their environment. And that was one of the points I wanted to make. And so, I think what I'd like to do is to sort of summarize at this point my points. I was going to talk more about stem cells, but maybe we should save that for the afternoon. But just so all species have this ability to generate new neurons, but it's unique to this area of the hippocampus. And another part that there is another area that this does occur in, and I haven't spent a lot of time on it, but it occurs in the olfactory system, in the smelling system. But it's dominant in lower animals and not so important in humans. Interestingly, we don't use smell as humans as much. It's important to us, but we don't use it as much. An animal that loses its ability to smell will die, whereas humans are anosmic. Sometimes we wish we couldn't smell. You know? But so there's two areas of the brain, but we know much more about this in the hippocampus. And surprisingly, these are derived from stem cells. And we have in our brain stem cells that are what we call multipotent. Because, though I haven't emphasized this, they not only can give rise to neurons, they can give rise to all the different cells of the brain. So they're busy micro-repairing the brain all the time. I just want to say one thing about this. I focused everything on the hippocampus as an example, you know, because that's where neurogenesis occurs. Neural stem cells exist everywhere in your brain and your spinal cord, but they don't give rise to neurons. They don't make connections. What they do is they make other cells to help repair small differences, but they can't give rise to neurons in those areas. But if you take the stem cells from, say, the spinal cord and put them in a dish, and like I showed you before, they will grow, and you can make them become neurons.
From the spinal cord?
Yes. If you take them out of the spinal cord. Okay. So this is another example where the environment is restricting their ability. And part of our goal as scientists is to understand why the hippocampus has the ability to teach these stem cells to become neurons. So that maybe we could learn how to train those cells in other places to repair or to enhance function in other parts of the brain. We know nothing. We know very little. I wouldn't say we know nothing, but part of our goal for understanding this is to translate that local environmental knowledge to other parts of the body, other parts of the brain and the spinal cord to enhance our function in those areas too. So that's sort of a longer-term goal. In fact, you can take a cell from the spinal cord as a stem cell and transplant it into an adult hippocampus, and it will become a hippocampal neuron from the spinal cord. So it has all the intrinsic capacity to do it, but the environment is not there to allow it to do it. So this process of neurogenesis is a process. It involves proliferation. Then it has to make a decision what kind of cell it's going to become. Then it's got to migrate to the right location, and then it makes all its connections. So it's a multi-step process. And the environment the local environment is some, we call it its niche, you know, that mm-hmm. is critical for the environment. And I know that you've asked questions about if we can separate out the intrinsic ability of the cell from its environment. How much of it is intrinsically determined? How much of it is environmentally determined? And it is also, it's a very much a scientific question. How much of it is genetically programmed and how much of it is environmentally determined? And we say this many other ways in science. How much of it is nature and how much of it is nurture? It's the same question, but now differently. How much does the cell autonomously have control over who it's going to be versus how much does the environment tell the cell how much it's going to be? And the answer is that the cell has the cells in the brain, the stem cells in the brain, have a limited amount of ability. So they're restricted, but not completely restricted. And it's that door of openness that allows the environment to manipulate what they're going to be. And that's why maybe, you know, the discussion of embryonic stem cells is so important, because embryonic stem cells are what we call pluripotent. It can become liver, brain, hair, cell, heart, everything. The question is whether or not, and it's a very important question, can the cell in the hippocampus only become a cell of the hippocampus, a hippocampal cell? And the answer is no. You have to find another area of the brain where neurogenesis occurs in order to be able to ask that question. And so this is why we can do this experiment, because the olfactory bulb makes neurons too. And if you take a neuron from the hippocampus and put it into the olfactory bulb, it becomes an olfactory bulb neuron. So at least it is immature enough to, again, respond to the environment to become, the environment tells it what it's going to become, but within restriction. If you put it into the cortex, it won't become a cortical neuron. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's because it can't become a cortical neuron. It's because the cortex doesn't have the information to tell it to become mm-hmm. a cortical neuron. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Again, it's how much of it is the environment and how much of its intrinsic ability. So I'm just sort of sub... And the other part was, it's not a fixed event. It doesn't just happen. It's highly regulated. The environment, activity, all the different experiences we have regulate the rate and fate of these cells. And they are functional. We know that now. The identity of these cells is something we have actually identified, so that you can, if you look in the brain now with sections, you can actually pick out which one and point to them, and we know now which ones are the stem cells. They're rather remarkable, but that's because they have certain genetic profiles that allows you to see who they are. In other work that I haven't described to you, we're learning the internal machinery and the genes and the chemicals that control the fates of the cells. And what we haven't done is to translate all the work we did in culture, when we can grow the cells and do all the chemistry and molecular biology, and translate that into endogenous. So your question about, is the behavior of the stem cell outside of the brain different from its behavior inside of the brain? We haven't solved that. We only know what they can do outside, and we know what they can do inside. We have to find a way to measure them in the same way. And we haven't. It looks the same, but I don't think we cannot be definitive about that. I don't know the answer. And we were learning about the function of it. But I think that while we talk about neurogenesis and we talk about new neurons, the most important thing, I believe, is the connectivity. It's not just if a cell is born, not just if it goes to the right place and survives, but it's this moment in time that the cell has where it makes connections. And this is the point. It takes at least a month for the proliferating cells to integrate into the neuron. And as you said, that doesn't make any sense in terms of time, you know, moment-to-moment interaction. That's not so important. So it isn't the birth of the cell. But it takes a long time for the cells to mature. And it's that window of maturity That's where we get 2 or 3 months of time where they're learning and making connections. That, I believe, is the advantage of having new birth. It's the ability of a young cell, and we call this, so the persistence of self-renewing developmental capacity in a new neuron, in a new hippocampus. So one of the areas that this idea that the brain is plastic, and so I'm a neurobiologist, and I think the brain is the structure which controls our behavior. This is the brain, and it controls our behavior. Surprisingly, maybe not surprising to you, but the environment and our experiences change our brain. So who we are as a person changes by virtue of our environment. And one of the ways in which this has an implication that we've never thought about it is that we live in physical environments. We work in buildings. We work in, people are in hospitals. And yet the connection between what is healthy architecture? What is a healthy design? What is the optimal environment for the brain to structure itself in a way? I work at an institute called the Salk Institute, which is it was designed by a famous architect, and it's some people think it's quite beautiful. Someday I hope you'll come visit us. But I will say that people think that some of the science there is very good. I can't say, but you know, but and they've said, is the science? So the question is, is the science that is done there, is it better and very good because it's in a beautiful setting? Does the environment have an impact on what's going on? So you could say that. How do you answer that question? How do you do it? How do you begin to answer that question? And people now are beginning to try to design or ask questions as to whether or not aesthetic features of an environment, or you know, beauty, some sort of the aesthetic value of it, is that does that have an outcome that can make your experience or your effectiveness? Can you be more effective? And I'll only point out that it is a pretty building, but if you look inside the building itself, it has a remarkable feature. And unlike buildings like this where you have walls, and most buildings have pillars or walls inside, it was designed in a way so you have 30,000 square feet of space without any pillars. And in the ceilings is where all the water and electricity exists. So for every, it all comes down from the ceiling and all the walls are soft. So in my laboratory, I've been there in this one space for 10 years. But I've changed it 9 times around because you can knock the walls down because they're made out of soft and just pull the plugs up. Mm-hmm. So is a space effective because it's beautiful or because it's functional? You know, and again, these kinds of separations, if you have to look at them very carefully, and even sometimes when you look at them carefully, you can't really get a solution to it. So if you look very carefully at this and you try to count the black dots, if you look at this image.
I think the dot is the same.
Well, it's an illusion. Every time you focus on one, it shifts. Right? So it's depending upon the environment. So the local effect is depending upon the surround.
Red, is that unusual?
Well, you're just seeing red because of the computer. If you look here, it's the lighting, but it's red versus white. But right, the point is that if you look at any one individual dot and you try to look at a red dot, it all turns white each time you look at the white. And yet if you look at the global, you can see the red dots, but when you focus, you can't see them. Anyway, a small illusion for the point. Maybe it wasn't such a good idea. Okay, I'm done. Thank you.
So Liz was just asking, is this just an optical illusion? Or
yes, it's
is
an
it
optical
really
illusion.
The distance here, Yuta.
It also seems to be a difference in the distance because His Holiness cannot see over there. He can see
here.
He can
see it here, right.
We thought we would begin with we think a central idea that came out in Rusty's presentation, the idea that our brains are continuously generating new cells in this region of the brain, the hippocampus. And this is occurring throughout the entire life of each individual. In the West, we have a very solid concept of self, which is fixed, relatively fixed over time, and a sense of immutability.
세계에서 말하지?
많아, 많아, 많아. 지용계.
어, 뉴베스톤.
그래. 네 배배, 네 배배.
어, that's not a scientific idea, though.
No, not a scientific. Although in psychology, there is a notion of self, which is described as being relatively.
The soul, says the word. Soul.
We're not talking about soul here, are we?
No, 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 not soul.
On a self, such.
Representation of self. So the kind of scientific evidence that we now have indicates that we're continuously generating new cells, and over the course of, what is it, 6 to 7 years, is that we have a full turnover?
It's longer time, but the point is that there's turnover over time.
There's turnover over time. So the question is, how can we reconcile the sense of continuity or immutability and a relatively fixed notion of self with the notion that the brain is continuously turning over, cells dying, cells being born? And this seems to be a point of intersection with Buddhism, with the Buddhist understanding of change. And so we thought that this would be a good point of departure for us this afternoon to begin this dialogue. To begin with this question of conflict between the biological evidence that indicates this continuous process of death and rebirth of cells and the psychological experience of this continuity and preservation of the self. So I think this also is a point where it's important to raise the idea of the role of mental training to investigate our experience in a more detailed way so that we have a deeper understanding of this process of change, which may actually be more consistent with our modern understanding of what is occurring with the death and rebirth of new cells in the brain.